As you get a little bit older, right? Like you realize, oh, that's all that I have is time. The rest of it is all irrelevant. And what you do to maximize that time, in my opinion, is what makes for a fulfilling life.
Welcome to the Action Academy Podcast.
Stand back while I celebrate freedom.
The show where we help you achieve financial independence with the mindsets, methods, and actionable steps from guests who've already earned their freedom.
The flags of freedom fly.
Choose to do what you want.
What you want.
With who you want.
With who you want.
When you want.
When you want.
With another episode today. Now, here's your host, Brian Lubin.
Welcome back to another episode of the Action Academy Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Brian Lubin, bringing you the mindsets, methods, and actionable steps for you to earn freedom in your life and business today. If you haven't already, you've got to go into the show description and click on the link to sign up for the Action Academy newsletter. That thing is sending out today, every Thursday, 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern Standard Time. And what it includes is going to be the top mindset, investing, and business tips from the entrepreneurs on this podcast every single week in a 5-minute read. So imagine having 10 hours of interviews, 5 hours of interviews, and they're all condensed into a 5-minute read. That's what's going to your inbox today, 10 o'clock Eastern. For today's show, we have an operations guy through and through with Chris Benson. Chris is the chief investment officer for a self-storage syndication company, Reliant Self-Storage, and he has a portfolio in the 8-figure range of self-storage and multifamily. So this guy knows what he's talking about, and he is actively in the weeds operationally of both finding, underwriting, managing, and purchasing self-storage facilities in the southeastern United States. So for today's show, we're going to start with Chris's path in his real estate investing journey, where he begins with single family, goes to multi, and then eventually ends up in self-storage. Then we're going to talk about how he runs the operations and what he looks for in investments when it comes to self-storage. And then he gives advice to people that are looking to get into the space about what he would do, what he should have done differently, along with a lot of actionable advice that you can use in your wealth building journey today. So you're going to want to listen to the entire podcast all the way through. As always, if you are enjoying the show, how we grow is by you going in the top right corner, hitting the subscribe button, and also leaving us a 5-star rating and a review on the show, especially on Apple Podcasts. That helps a lot. So thank you all. Hope you enjoy. And without any further ado, Chris Benson. Chris Benson, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, Brian?
Doing fantastic. I've got a tree in the yard, but horizontally, but that's a problem that, hey, real estate, right? Pass it on. It's all good, man. I'm excited to have you on. We've met multiple times now, and I know that you are actually one of the local leaders for GoBundance, our local chapter here in Atlanta. And that's how we met. And I'm excited to hear about the wonderful world of self-storage, because that's what you guys are into. Can you introduce yourself and walk us through where you're at right now, and then we'll deconstruct it?
Yeah, be happy to. So as you mentioned, we are a self-storage operator. So I'm the chief investment officer at Reliant Real Estate Management. We are a vertically integrated self-storage operator, meaning we buy and manage self-storage properties primarily here in the Southeast. We have 73 sites right now and just over 6 million net rentable square feet across 8 states. But most of it, Brian, Florida, Georgia, Carolinas, Alabama, Tennessee, Colorado is where the bulk of the, or where the portfolio is right now. And we're growing. We've had an incredible run the last kind of 5 years, and as many of the real estate asset classes have, and we're hoping to continue to grow that.
That's very exciting to hear. And when it comes to real estate asset classes, self-storage keeps poking its head out. And I want to get into the whole asset class at large in the back half of the interview. But for the front half, I really want to figure out what got you, like your backstory, what got you here, what drew you to this company in general. So walk us a little bit back about beginning your investment journey in real estate and how this all materialized.
Yeah, happy to. My story started with, I was in sales out of college. So corporate sales. My oldest son is 21 and he'll be 21 June 15th. I'm 42. So if you do that math, Brian, that means I had my kid's senior year in college.
Attaboy.
So we grew up fast for sure. And essentially I got into sales because it was what I thought I could make the most money, buy diapers and pay rent. That was generally my thought process. And I had done a number of different roles in sales. My last real job was with a company called Intuitive Surgical. They make the Da Vinci robot. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Da Vinci surgical robot, but it was an incredible organization. I was super blessed to be a part of it. But Brian, the story I'm about to tell is pretty much what every real estate investor tells, and their origin stories are all very similar. I was trading time for money. And as far as checking the boxes, doing great. Like I was making a bunch of money and had good title. And on the scale of societal measures, things were good. But I was traveling a ton. Our kids were, I missed a lot of stuff just because I was out grinding. And I still remember waking up when I was 30-ish, 29-ish and saying, I'm not doing this for another 30 years. There's no way. And it was like that knot in your stomach. You just knew something was wrong. And what used to really get me, Brian, is airports. Like I'd be at an airport in some terrible place, Detroit or Minneapolis, no offense, but
sorry guys.
Yeah. Thursday night at like 8:30 trying to get home and just being miserable. And I'd see some guy walk by in a suit at, he's a 60. And I was like, nope, I am not doing that. So for me, the journey started with Rich Dad Poor Dad, like a lot of guys, where that was my eye opener. I was like, oh, passive income. Yep, that makes sense. And we went down a path that many investors do. We bought duplexes in the town that we lived in upstate New York at the time. And I had 22 units and hated all of them. I hated the tenants. I hated the buildings. I hated everything. And I wish I could give credit to who said it to me, but someone said big deals and small deals are the same amount of work. You just make less money in small deals. And I was like, got it. Just need to scale. And it's so true, especially as we've grown. You only have so many hours in the day and you can work on things that make you $100 or things that make you $1,000, but it's still the same number of hours. And we ended up building a 64 unit multifamily complex. And that was the beginning of the light bulbs for me, Brian, where I was like, this is how you make money in real estate. And yeah, it was, I don't know how much further you want to go before you jump in, but that was the beginning of big boy real estate investing and saying, got it. This is how you can divest yourself away from the 9 to 5.
Cool. Perfect. That's an awesome origin story in a couple of different areas that I want to take you here. First, let's start with the mindset shift between we have the same hours in the day. Instead of doing all these small little deals, I want to do one big deal. And so it's not a natural progression normally for someone to go from 22 units, which I'm assuming you were just picking up small multi after small multi and then just be like, oh, I'm going to develop a 64 unit. That's a jump and that's a leap. So you heard this quote, you took action on it. What is the differentiator between all these other people that are hitting singles after singles? And we're not downplaying that at all. It's good to be on base. What do you think is the main limiter and the differentiator between the people that finally it clicks to just do the big deal and go for the big deal, as opposed to the people that just keep doing like 10% more, 10% more, 10% more?
It's all got to be what you're comfortable with too, Ryan, right? Like there's not a right or a wrong answer to that. If you're comfortable and your constitution makes singles feel good, do it. I just looked at it and said, how am I going to scale this to the point that I wanted to get to? And I wasn't happy doing the part that I was doing. I think a big part of it is things that people already know. Fear is the biggest limiting factor. That's the, at least for me, hardest thing to get over whenever we're doing anything new is stepping out and saying, hey, I'll figure it out. I may not know all the answers today, but generally, historically in my life, at least, I figured it out most of the time without too many catastrophic errors. I think the first thing is just being willing to say, look, I don't know everything today, but I'll take that first step. And then the next day, take that next step and figure out what you need to figure out as you go. Because if you're waiting for all the answers, and this is what I see a lot of with just people in all different phases, and we all struggle it to some degree. I think about myself where we are now on what I want to do next in the business. I'm still in that waiting phase where I want to understand more before I do it. It doesn't matter at what level of a game you're at. We all still struggle with it. I think it's just understanding that you're not going to have all the answers when you have to take the first step. And that can be launching a podcast or buying your first commercial real estate project or buying your first duplex. And the only way to learn is jump in and figure it out.
I find that interesting because normally somebody in your position would have the opposite temperament. Because how old were your kids at that time?
When I was 30, Noah was 10-ish. So,
yeah. So you had a family. Normally that's the big, right? Is people are like, oh, I've got a family to support. I can't afford to take risk. What if it goes south? So that's why your perspective is interesting there, because normally whenever I talk to people, it was the opposite. They said, hey, I had that family young. I started them young. That caused me to be risk averse, but you were able to push past that and through that. And that's why I wanted your perspective there. That's very interesting.
Yeah, and I'm just part of it too, Brian, right? Like my biggest fear in life is regret. I don't want to look back and be like, man, should have tried that. So I'm 42. When I turned 40, I had some interesting conversations with myself about you're halfway, rough and tough. I know there's a lot of GoBundance guys listening who think they're going to be 125 years old. Whatever. Give it a shot. You're probably not going to have as much fun at 125 as you are right now. For me, I just wanted to make sure that I was squeezing what I could squeeze out of the lemon, get all the juice out that I can. And if you look back at your life and say, hey, I gave it a great run, that's all I want. It's not about money. It's not about that. That stuff doesn't matter, especially as you get older and you have a little bit of it. It's just, oh, that doesn't really do anything for me. And I think for me, it was just saying, all right, I'm willing to jump, because if I don't, 10 years from now, I'm going to look back at 50 or at 40 and be like, shit, I should have tried that.
Man, that's a powerful perspective to have. I wish more people, because this is a whole tangent that I've been going on recently. Daniel Pink, he should be coming on the show. He's an author. He's coming on the show in a couple of months. And he talks about the two different types of regret. And then there's the regret that you have for things that you've done. And you're like, oh, shit, I should not have done that. You're like, I shouldn't have gotten that bar fight. I shouldn't have gotten drunk that one night. I shouldn't have dated this person. And then you have the different type of regret, which is the regret of things that you didn't do that you should have. And I should have talked to that girl. I should have left that job. I should have followed my passion. I should have started that business. In the first 20 years of life, the studies say that regret number one is the most prevalent, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's people that are just, we're not fully developed. We're just acting. We're like, ah, shit, shouldn't have done that. And then the rest of your life, it's regret number two that is the most lasting, the what ifs. Like, where did it go? You and I had a conversation at a GoBundance meeting. I won't divulge like the details of it. I'll leave that extent up to you if you want to. But we talked about the concept of, I believe you referenced Tim Ferriss with like an 8 out of 10 life. But that was very impactful for me. And I would love for you to share that, because I immediately took that home and implemented that.
Yeah, you're making it sound like it was more exciting than it was, I think. There was no, it wasn't
no,
that.
That's a good one, man.
I'm crediting Tim Ferriss. I just stole his thing, but yeah.
It was impactful.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's a great lens to look at things. And Brian, you're still young, right? How old are you?
27.
Yeah, so man, you should still be regretful for all the dumb stuff you're going to do. You got plenty of time to regret what you're not going to.
I have no regrets. I just only have lessons, my friend.
Yeah, Tim Ferriss says essentially rank everything in how the subject of him using this was books. You're reading a book and rank it 1 to 10. You can't use 7. If it's not an 8, 9, or a 10, stop reading it and go get a different book. Because he breaks it down in that you only can read so many books in your lifetime, right? There's only, most people have a finite resource of time that they can use to read books. And so don't waste it on something that you don't actually like or get a lot out of. And I was like, that's a fantastic way to look at life. Rank everything you do 1 to 10. Can't use 7, because everybody uses 7. It's just like the word meh.
Yeah, meh, good 7. Enough.
And so if it's not an 8, 9, or a 10, don't do it anymore. And it's not feasible to do with everything, but it's a good lens. When I'll give you an example. So this past weekend, my neighbor, he just finished his basement, came out beautiful. He wanted to have like couples poker night. Mm-hmm. If I didn't like him, or if I was thinking like, hey, this isn't going to be that fun, I wouldn't have went. I would have been like, yeah, that's a 6. I'm not going to go to that. It gets uncomfortable sometimes. Like my wife had a family event a few weeks ago where she went home for a birthday for a family member. And she said, you want to go? I was like, no, that's a 5. I'm not going to go do that. We'll see how far I can get away with it. But it is a good way to think about it as far as how you build what you do in your life. Because ultimately, Brian, and as you get a little bit older, right, like you realize, oh, that's all that I have is time. The rest of it is all irrelevant. And what you do to maximize that time, in my opinion, is what makes for a fulfilling life.
I agree with that. And the whole premise that you laid with this. Like you thought it was a casual quote, but I immediately started ranking things in my head as soon as you said that. And people, like, this is a testament to proximity is power. Get around people that are having these conversations, get around people locally, because Chris and I are local here and we were able to meet up with our local chapter. These are the conversations that move the needle forward and move the ball down the field. And I immediately went back and I thought, hey, what is an 8 out of 10 for me in my life? Because you and I, our group, GoBundance, people listening to this podcast, none of us are going to be okay with having a good enough life. We all want a great, a fantastic, a phenomenal, an outstanding life. And so I thought that was a huge takeaway for me, because I immediately was like, okay, what's a 7 or beneath? And then I found a couple things and I eliminated them very fast. And that includes, unfortunately, some relationships.
Sure. Yeah.
And that's a big part of it, is if it's a relationship where you're like, you're just hanging on just for time, it's time to move on. So speaking of moving on, you are developing, you make your mindset shift, you start developing 64 unit ground up development, right? Take us on the journey from going into this multifamily space to getting partnered up with Reliant and then getting intrigued by self-storage, because I'm very intrigued by self-storage. And I think it's a great area to look at as we move into this new economic cycle that seems to be looming on us.
Yeah. So for me, it starts with being wrong, as most things in my life seem to be. So
very fair.
Probably 6 years ago, I said cap rates couldn't possibly compress any further than they already had at that point. Whoops. So in my head, I was like, I got to look at other asset classes where there's still meat on the bone. Multifamily's done what it's going to do. It's just going down from here. I was a little bit too early on that one, but I'm a data guy, Brian. So I like looking at historical numbers and how asset classes have performed. And for me, I looked at really two asset classes that I really liked, which was mobile home parks and self-storage. And 6-7 years ago, they were kind of like the redheaded stepchild of real estate. And you had the core four of office, multifamily, retail, industrial. And then there's all these weird nuancey things like data centers and storage and mobile home parks and car washes. And they were all on the fringe of commercial real estate. And what I fell in love with self-storage is there's really three pillars that I looked at, which was historical performance, you know, what they've done over the last 25 years, which is an incredible number. And I'll share you the data in just a second. And then what do they do in recession? I'm a huge believer that everything's cyclical, right? So if it's going to happen in the future, if you believe Ray Dalio and his approach to things, it's already happened. You just have to look back far enough in history to see it. And so with storage in 2007, 8, 9, storage did really well. That was proved out again during COVID. 2021 for self-storage in the industry was one of the best in the history of the asset class, and Reliant as well. I was really looking at, all right, historically it's done well. It's got great recession resilience. And then the third pillar for me was it still had a runway. Right now, about 30% of the square footage in the US is owned by publicly traded companies. So there's 5 publicly traded REITs and then a U-Haul, which is public, but they're not a REIT. And the rest of the market is still very fragmented. So what that means for a company like us at Reliant is you can essentially consolidate that market. And just like any private equity strategy, you roll it up into something bigger and then all the big boy money wants to come buy it. Because a group like Blackstone, they have to deploy $1 billion in the space is not easy when the equity check is $5 million a deal. So they're very interested in these very large transactions. And so for me, that's what got me interested in the asset class. And then Reliant specifically, I was an investor first. Essentially, I was a passive investor in one of their syndications and said, love what you guys are doing. And at that point, I was doing real estate full time. And Todd Allen, who's the managing principal of Reliant and has built the company, him and his partner, Lou, we just formed a good relationship and he needed help on scaling. And I said, here's what I think I could do to help. Let's give it a run. And jumped in, and I didn't know everything, but I'm a big believer you bet on the people, and love Todd and love what he stood for and what he was trying to build. And it's been a fun adventure ever since. Yeah, we've been on a skyrocketing trajectory since then.
So speaking of data, I'd love to go into the data here with you. And also to that note, there was in our retreat, talk about swag when it comes to data.
You mean what it stands for?
Yeah.
Yeah. Scientific wild ass guess.
Yeah. I loved it, man. I loved the candor because we're going into future projections. And then you were talking about the degree of accuracy that people can actually predict future profitability. And you're like, at this point, it's just, you just had swag, swagger it out. And everyone's like, what's swag? And you're like, oh yeah, that's my scientific wild ass guess about what will happen with my crystal ball.
Yeah, look, we're in this game where people expect you to predict the future. It's a fool's errand, Ryan, right? To say where cap rates or values are going to be 5-6 years from now is ridiculous. Now, everybody does it, but that's not what you're betting on. Let me give you this as an example, something to think about. With Reliant, we've sold 38 properties, and our average IRR is a 33, which is bonkers, right? At the project level, that's a crazy number. We projected that on exactly zero properties, which means we've been wrong every time, right? We've sold 38 of these things and we've been wrong every time we sold them, but we've been wrong the right way. We've been wrong to the conservative end. So they've outperformed projections. So people are like, hey, you're a genius. Nope, we're still wrong. We didn't know what values were going to be when we were ready to sell them, but we were just happened to be wrong in the way you made money. So people are like, hey, you guys did a great job. Did we? We can be wrong the other way too. And I think that's the part where people get hung up on this projection thing. You're not betting on projections. Does it matter? Yes. Is it going to be something that everybody is measured against? It sure is. But from my perspective, with real estate specifically in these passive syndications, you're betting on team and track record. You're betting on who are the people that are going to make the decisions that ultimately impact, do I make money on my investment or not? And have those people done what they said they're going to do in the future? Have they done that before? And if they have, you got great people and historically they've done what they say they're going to do in the next 5 years. I'm not going to say it's 100% guaranteed, but generally it's probably going to turn out okay. And there's always black swan events, right? And you could have been a great hotel operator and COVID happened. I mean, it's hard to run a business when there's no revenue. I think you got to just think about what, if you're looking at these passive investment type opportunities, nobody knows. No one knows what the future is going to be. And anybody who's guaranteeing a return, I was listening to a podcast yesterday, actually, where someone on an advertisement in the podcast said a minimum 20% return. And immediately what I think is, nope, I will never, ever talk to that person because it's just egregious. Like, no one knows. That's my own lens of being somewhat cynical, but I think people just need to reframe what they're looking at when they say, all right, I'm looking for this kind of investment. What you really want is the people who are going to do a great job for you in that investment.
I love that. And it always comes down to people at the end of the day. It's always a people conversation. People produce the profits, not the deals. I'm curious about your advice. I want to speak to two different people here now. I want to speak to maybe the recreational investor that is talking about maybe diving in themselves individually to self-storage, and maybe the person that's looking to dive into the syndication realm. What advice would you give to the person? We'll start with the newbie syndicator. What is the right way to go about this? Because what I see, I'm making an assumption that this is what you see too, is we see a lot of people out there running syndications that don't know what the hell they're doing and they have no track record. So of course you would rip them apart. My challenge and my ask is, what is a good path of progress for someone that is new and that is wanting to develop that track record and develop that trust? What is the path of progress for that person? So say that someone that's maybe in your position, they've been successful in multifamily, maybe they have some single family, they've been an operator before, but they want to move into self-storage. Maybe move as an LP like you did and then have a conversation with the GP, ride in somebody else's wake and then break off. What would be your advice?
Yeah, I think Brian, it goes back to the end goal, right? What you're trying to do. If you can identify what you want the end point to be and then reverse engineer your way there, it's a great place to start. Look, I think you're asking a couple of questions. The first one is, what do you say to somebody who's new to syndication, maybe doesn't have the track record? Look, if you don't have the experience, just be very thoughtful of what you're asking for people. Money is one of those weird things where it is a representation of time, right? Because we spend our time generating that capital to be able to invest it. So if you do a bad job with it, you've stolen that person's time. They can't ever get it back. Just understand the responsibility of that, because it's a big deal. And there's a lot of trust that goes in that. But everybody starts somewhere. And it usually starts with friends and family. Like Brian, if you said, hey, tomorrow I need to go raise $500,000, I'm going to go do my first duplex or quad in the Woodstock area, the Atlanta area, you're not going to go randomly advertising. You're going to go ask people who trust Brian. And ultimately, that's where it always starts, is with friends and family. And then as you start to develop a track record, you can start to think about, okay, how do I start bringing, I think I know what I'm doing. I feel comfortable. If I take someone's money, I'm probably not going to lose it. And I can hopefully generate some appreciation for them. And then you start to bring some newer people in. What I would say is, being a syndicator is now just a thing. Like, you'll see it all over YouTube and all over LinkedIn. And man, just because you have a podcast, no offense, or a YouTube channel, or
none taken.
Yeah. Or some sort of internet thought leadership platform, doesn't mean you're a real estate operator. And so from to the investor side of this, I would be equally as interested in, are you a marketing company? Or are you a real estate operator? And sometimes it's a balance of both. And great real estate companies have created great marketing machines. That's usually pretty good. There's a lot of people out there that have created great marketing machines. And the real estate, we'll see. It's too early, early to tell. But time will play that out. But I think it's just being thoughtful, back to the advice part, and one foot in front of the other. Don't go too fast. Don't just try to earn fees. Because ultimately, people are trusting in you to deliver for them. And when you lose capital, it feels bad. There's a lot of people with a lot of really horrible stories out there, because it's just a blind trust. And most people, Brian, you know, if you go out to your network and say, hey, I need some capital, they're not going to do due diligence on the deal. They're just betting that you did your homework. Just make sure that you did.
Very good advice. Very solid advice. Let's talk to the person that is looking to buy their first self-storage deal. I have no idea how to underwrite one of these things. So you can speak to me directly. I know the concept. So speak to me as a newbie, and maybe to someone, like I said, that's invested in multifamily before. They understand the concepts of real estate and they understand all the how businesses work and operate. What are you looking for? What makes a good deal for self-storage? And what are you looking for in value add opportunities when you're underwriting? Yeah.
So let's take a step back from that first and say, so there's been a couple of GoBundance guys who've asked me this, right? Where they're like, hey, will you look at this self-storage deal? And the first question I ask is, why are you investing in self-storage? If you have a business that you are successful in and you're making a bunch of money, understand, do you want to really be a direct investor in these asset classes? Not just storage, anything. Or do you want to just keep making money the way you want to make money and deploy money capital or passively? And this is where I go back to the 10,000 hour rule, right? Generally, it takes 10,000 hours to make an expert. If you, Brian, don't know anything about self-storage and you say, hey, I want to buy a self-storage facility, I would say, okay, is that what gets you fired up? Do you want to spend 10,000 hours figuring out how to run self-storage? And if the answer to that is yes, go get it, right? And we could talk about maybe the specific things you want to look for in a deal. But if you're just enamored with the asset class, well, do what you do that made you the money to invest in the first place. Don't dip your toe in and be use the word recreational, which I love, a recreational investor. Don't do that. It's going to end really badly, right? If you have a business where you're crushing it, go crush it and deploy money with people who've already put their 10,000 hours in. Brian, think of it this way. Dalio says this. For those of you guys who don't know him, at one point he started Bridgewater Capital. I think they're still the largest hedge fund in the world. I don't know, $180 billion under management or something stupid.
Small potatoes.
But, what's that?
Small potatoes.
Yeah, whatever. But he always says, look, the stock market's a zero-sum game and you're not going to beat me. He's like, I have the smartest people on the planet working for me. And you, Brian, are going to go trade in the market and beat me? He's like, nope, put your money in an index fund because you're not going to beat me. And I look at it the same way. It's look, is Reliant perfect? Absolutely not. Some guy's going to go build his first storage facility or her first storage facility. We have 180 employees that all we do all day, every day is storage. That's it. One thing. And here's a doctor. He's an orthopedic surgeon. He's like, I'm going to buy a storage facility. Really? Go fix knees and put money with a group like Reliant or other people who've put their time in. So for me, that's always like the balance of, do you really want to learn this? Because I did it, right? And I didn't like it. Once I did it, I was like, oh, I don't want to operate. This isn't what I want. And so I push back on that and just say, first answer that question for yourself is, where do you want, you only have so many 10,000 hour blocks in your life, right? And back to our time conversation, where do you want to spend your time? If that gets you fired up to wake up in the morning and go do it every day, there's money to be made for sure. But if you're just like, oh, I just like the asset class, go write a check to somebody, let them do it.
That's fair. That's very fair. I get the perspective. Let's talk to that person that is in the hunt.
Yep.
Like maybe they're not the surgeon, and because I also have friends in this. I've got friends in every angle of everything. So I've got friends that are like you that are running the syndications, and I have friends that are saying, "Hey, I don't have capital. I don't have any of this, but I got hustle and I want to get cash flow and I want to get equity, and I'm willing to put 10,000 hours into this thing to figure this out." And they do self storage. So let's speak to all of them, because I do really admire that perspective, though, because that's a one that's not offered as much. But I completely agree with you. If you have career capital and you have a zone of genius that you've been operating in that made you profitable, or maybe you have another core tree trunk, as Matt Aitchison would say, if you have another core tree trunk, don't keep building new bridges. But if you want to build this bridge, what was some advice that you can give to people to avoid falling into the freaking water while they build? Geez, baby.
I think that the interesting piece is you use the word hustle, right? So in every deal, and I think Brandon always used to say this, right? It was like, mm-hmm. There's hustle, there's money, and there's knowledge, right?
Yep.
And generally there's somebody always has two out of the three. They may have the knowledge, they may have the hustle, but they don't have any money. You can always go get that third part of the triangle. And to your point, I think for somebody new coming into the asset class, it's education first, right? Get yourself comfortable with the asset class. Go partner with some people if you can who have the expertise, and you bring them one piece of that. Hustle, knowledge, money, whatever one that you have or combination. But I think specifics in the asset class, Brian, are not too dissimilar than any asset class. We're looking at all the same demographic data that everybody, traffic count, income, average housing price, to understand what's in the particular market. But with storage, it's very interesting in that we used to look at a 1, 3, and 5 mile radius around the site to understand its addressable market. We've since changed that to drive time, because in some markets, 5 miles away might be 20-minute drives. Nobody's driving 20 minutes to get to a storage facility. Remember, this is a garage. There's no amenities. This isn't like apartments where there's a school district or you can walk to shopping and restaurants and that's attractive. It's a heated and air-conditioned or not garage. It's a box on a metal cement pad. And so it's really convenient to work or home, or you're not using it. You're not going there. So from our perspective, it's understanding what's happening in that. We sometimes go 10 to 15 minute of drive time to this facility and what's around it. That's really our addressable market. That's where we spend the most time understanding, hey, who's going to fill this thing up? Or if we build additional units, who's going to rent those units? And is this a market we want to play in? But I think that's where I would really start to get comfortable, is underwriting the market and understanding how it's your addressable market is going to impact your business plan. And then understanding there's a lot of things in that underwriting package as far as the competitive set, who are you competing against, and the rates they're charging, those types of things, where that's data that you start to get more comfortable with. But I think what we do a really good job of is we call it the story of the market, like understanding what the story is. So like when our acquisitions team and we sit in an investment committee and have a conversation about a deal, that's the conversation, right? Is, okay, tell me the story. Like, why does this work? And then we start with that, and then the details are built in around the story. So I think for that guy out hustling or gal who's out hustling, it starts with, okay, let me understand why I want to be in this particular market. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. And like I said, that's a unique perspective, but that's very valuable. So what are reasons that you shouldn't do self-storage? Speak to that person and just tell them all the reasons that they shouldn't. Who is self-storage for?
As an investor, you mean?
Yeah. So let's finish. Let's put a cap on the person that is looking to get educated. Maybe they want to dive in and get educated on self-storage in general. And then we can go ahead and put a cap on that. But what are the reasons that they shouldn't? What are the people that shouldn't do it? Obviously, besides the ones that just are not willing to put in 10,000 hours.
Yeah, I think the misconception, and look, it depends on what kind of level you're at with self-storage, is, you know, you don't really have tenants, there's no bathrooms, you don't have to go on clock toilets, so it's 100% passive. It's not really true. Storage is interesting in that they're 30-day leases, right? So there is no 12-month lockup, right, Brian? If you rent a unit today on May 23rd, you can be out on June 23rd. So it's an operational business that just happens to be wrapped in a real estate play. And so there's a lot of churning around it. If you're not comfortable with the operational side, we spend a lot of time on digital marketing. How do we get tenants access to the units, rent online? They literally don't have to go to the office anymore. And there are some self-storage operators, Brian, out there who are completely automating the site. There's no people on site. So everything is done through a kiosk model or a call center. And they've used technology to supplement the human element. And we do that to some extent as well. But I think for people who just come in and be like, look, it's just a bunch of garages, I can rent it and never touch it, that's probably not, it's not passive. At least in our business, it isn't at the level that we're at. I think that's one thing to keep in mind as you're looking at this is, There's an operational business component to this, and you got to be comfortable running and maintaining that aspect of it as well. And the real estate just happens to wrap the whole thing.
Okay. So come in being prepared to either A, operate the business and learn about operations of businesses, or B, have an operator in place ready to go, because it's not just going to be hands off. I'm going to do this seller finance, because that's why it's sexy. So that and mobile home parks are very seller financeable. That's essentially the draw. So that, and I specifically wanted to ask that question because I want people that are listening to always have the reasons, like you said, all the data. Why should I do this? Why should I not do this? Who is this for? Who's it not for? That's where the rubber meets the road. So yeah, I appreciate the perspective there. So moving, if you were to look back, is there anything that you would have done differently in your wealth building journey? Or do you appreciate all the moments that you had?
Is this philosophical or literal?
D, all of the above.
Look, philosophically, how I got here is going through all those things, right? So are there, to your point around the regrets, are there things that I wish I hadn't done? Sure. But they were a lesson, and I learned from them and moved forward and hopefully took those lessons into my decision-making today. But I think, Brian, on the overall, is there something I wish I did? I wish I'd started sooner, right? The best real estate tool or the best investment tool is time. And generally, if I had started at 27, everything that I owned at 47 would be worth more money. If I had started at 20, when I was 40, everything's worth more money. Whatever I buy today at 42, when I'm 62, generally, there's going to be ups and downs along the way, but it's going to be worth more money. I think I wish I had an understanding of what I wanted sooner. But again, it's all part of my
journey,
maturation and journey. Maybe Chris at 21 wasn't ready to hear what Chris at 30 had to hear to say, okay, I got to do something different. And that's all part of, we have two boys. And when you think of it as a parent, it's letting them go through their experiences and maturation until they get to a point where like, oh, that's what I want to do. Okay. Us telling them, that's not going to help.
No.
It's going to be like, yeah, I'm not interested in what you're saying.
Yeah. I love it. What's next? What's next for you? What's your 3-year vision here? Where do you want to take it?
Yeah, that's a good question. We get to ask that a lot, specifically with what does Reliant want to be when it grows up? I don't know. For me, Brian, and this is more philosophical probably than you're asking, but when I look at the next 40 years of my life, the lens other than the Tim Ferriss kind of rank it 1 to 10 is meaningful work, meaningful relationships. So if what I'm doing is in those two buckets, right, I'm building good relationships and I feel like the work is worthwhile, generally I'm happy. And look, 5 years from now, maybe that's different. But with Reliant right now, we're growing something and that's really fun. You don't get to do that too often, or at least most people don't get to do that too often in their careers. And so we're gonna grow this thing for all it's worth and see what we can do with it. I don't have an end point. It's interesting. So in our, for those guys who are part of GoBundance, our local meeting was at my house, Brian, before the Whirly Ball event that we did. And we asked that question, what's life look like in 3 years for you? And my answer was this, like, I love going to work. Like, I'm not one of the guys who's trying to get out and ski 600 days a year. Well, that'd be impossible. Ski 365 days a year.
No, Tim Rhodes could find a way to make it happen. He could ski 600 days a year.
That's right. I think for me, like, I enjoy it. I enjoy the process. I enjoy work. I'm doing what I want to do right now. And again, that may change. And I have the freedom to go when I want to go. And I'm good for about 4 days of vacation, Brian. And then I start to get antsy. At about day four, we went surfing in Puerto Rico for spring break in Rincon. And about day four, I start to get, I'm ready.
Yeah.
Like, first few days, awesome, having a great time. Day three, oh, this is fantastic. End of day four, I'm like, oh, I wonder what's happening at work. And then day five, I'm like, all right, I gotta go home.
Yeah. And that's the entire premise behind this trip that we're about to take. We're about to go travel. And my premise is, it's a giant experiment. So what I'm trying to be here is the guinea pig for everyone. Just says, hey, like, that sounds like a cool idea. Let's see it, you know, proof of concept, essentially. So I'm going to go do it, take extensive notes, record audio for people here on this podcast 4 times a week and grow this company that I have right here. And then just see the pros and cons of it, because I'm like you, there's never going to be a time in my life where I want to go just sit on a beach for 2 weeks. That's just, I think that is what the last 10 years has bred as being sexy. I want passive income. Everyone says they want $10,000 of passive income monthly so that they can retire and go travel, lay on the beach. I don't think that's the move. I think the pursuit of meaningful work that fires you up, working with people that you enjoy and respect, that's the pursuit, finding passionate, meaningful work. So I don't know.
Yeah. We'll figure it out. Brian, look, you're 27 too. 35-year-old Brian might think something different. And that's part of your maturation journey, life, right? I mean, that, and 45-year-old Chris might think different than 42-year-old Chris. And that's okay.
I hope we think different.
What's that?
I hope we think different.
Yeah. 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 You're evolving, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if you watch 60 Minutes. You're a little young for that, but.
I have watched 60 Minutes before, Chris. Not that young.
but last night they talked about this project called Hope Chicago. So this guy, he had started 5 businesses, had been wildly successful. He's a billionaire at 40, right? The biggest one was one of the largest cannabis growers in the world. And he's from Chicago originally. His foundation just built this project. They're going to basically donate $1 billion to do 30,000 college scholarships over the next 10 years in Chicago. And they're going to South Side of Chicago, really rough schools, and basically scholarshipping all the kids in the high school. Not only the kids, but one of their parents. So mom, dad, guardian, they get to choose. And what he's saying is, look, Chicago is a mess, right? But people under age 18, I think one of the biggest things contributing to the death rate of children under 18 is gunshot wound. And that's ridiculous. And so he's literally trying to change generational poverty by educating not only the kid, but the family members. And his belief is 10, 20 years from now, that's going to pay huge dividends to the community. And what I thought about is, like, what a cool shift for him, going from, he was a moneymaker, he was a rainmaker, and then said, nah, I'm going to change the world. Elon Musk is that guy too, right? Maybe a little bit weirder, but same idea. Like, that guy could have just disappeared and had a couple $100 million from his sale of PayPal and would have been just fine. Instead, he decided to figure out how to go to Mars and get rid of the internal combustion engine. Like, those are two just massive projects that are
crazy. Now traffic. He's trying to beat traffic.
Well, but he looks at a problem and says, yeah, we got to fix that.
Yeah.
And, but he's willing to be the guy to do it. And that's, I look at those kinds of things and like, that looks cool. Like, I love when people are just like, oh, that's a problem. Like, I'm going to fix that. Even if it's an obnoxiously large one, like crime and poverty in the city of Chicago. But that guy's going to make an impact. And what a legacy, right? Whether it works or not, it's hard to imagine that it won't. That guy looks back at his deathbed, Brian. He's probably not, I should have done that. He's probably squeezed the juice.
And that's why we do it. That's why we do all this. We're not doing this to buy the Lamborghinis. We're doing this to provide impact. You can impact more people if you have more wealth. Good people get good money. They can do great things. Quote my friend Chris Harder. But we will end it there, my friend. I don't think we can get much more impactful than that. Let's give a quick presentation for Reliant. Who are you looking for? What can you offer them for the accredited investors that are listening?
Yeah, we're always raising capital. You can learn more at reliant-mgmt.com if you are interested in passive investing opportunities with Reliant Real Estate. And we're generally always have something open that we're raising capital. Right now, we're doing a $100 million fund that will probably close out here at the end of the summer. And we'll have our fourth fund, Self-Storage Fund 4, that'll be open probably at the end of July. Yeah, if you're looking for that opportunity to passive on or to partner on the passive side of things, I'm biased, but I feel like we're a pretty good option.
Fair enough. And we will have all of that in the show description and also in the Action Academy newsletter that goes out every Thursday, which all of you should subscribe to. Chris, thank you, my friend. It has been a pleasure. Thank you for all your wisdom. Thank you for paving this path and setting us straight, man. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, sir. It's been Chris Benson and Brian with the Action Academy podcast, signing off.